GeekSpeak's podcast and website are brought to you by GNI, a full-featured web hosting facility that provides co-location services and high-bandwidth connectivity. More information about GNI is available at www.gnihosting.com.
It's Friday, September 2nd, 2005, 10:06 a.m. on the central coast of California. Today, we're starting out our month-long subject of digital photography. And, of course, it is time now for GeekSpeak. Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name is Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KOSP or its board, the Pataphysical Broadcasting Foundation. Today on GeekSpeak, after Spot of Geek News, we are speaking with Derek Story, author of The Digital Photography Pocket Guide by O'Reilly. Today's topics will be what digital cameras to get and some tips and tricks to get to take good pictures. That's today on GeekSpeak in a little bit after our news. And during the second half of the show, about half an hour from now, I'll welcome you to join our conversation. The numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877, or you can go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. It's very different to do the show without theme music in the background, and I'm missing it every moment. But we are lucky and blessed to have both Miles Elam, technical trainer of Surf Control, and Drew Meyer, storage specialist at Adaptec, here today on GeekSpeak. Welcome, geeks.
Good morning.
Howdy, Lyle.
Before we start our topic of digital photography, our month-long topic, we'll be doing a new piece specializing on digital photography the entire month of September.
Slow down there, Turbo.
Raining in the end. The music, he's all flustered.
Derek Story will be joining us, but let's first do some geek news. Miles, I know you got a few items of import. Please share.
Scientists at the Wistar Institute, a U.S. biomedical research center, have genetically engineered miracle mice. These are mice that can regenerate amputated limbs or damaged vital organs, making them able to recover from injuries that would kill or permanently disable normal animals. They are now the only mammals in existence that can regenerate, even though the ability is seen in things like starfish or...
Right, right.
Was there a radioactive accident that happened?
You know, I looked at that story when you sent it to me the other day, and I couldn't find out the reason why this happened. It's like they accidentally found out that these rodents could do this.
Right. Or at least that's the impression that I got as well. They were finding, for example, that this particular strain of mice, a strain known as MRL, were subjected to a series of surgical procedures where, for example, one mouse had its toes amputated, but the digits grew back complete with joints.
Fully functional.
It wasn't just, you know, some material came back.
And they damaged half the one of the hearts of the rodents.
Right.
They damaged
it
severely,
yeah.
and it came back.
Right. So
did they do something special to the mice, or this just happens?
I think it was accidental, because what was noted, the reason why they started testing these rodents, is that the mice, they have hole punches in the ears for tagging purposes, and they'd remove the tags and the holes would seal up and there'd be no sign at all of the problem. So then they go ahead and were like, well, what can they do? And they started testing them, like cutting off toes and stuff, which I guess scientists do all the time to rodents. Mm-hmm. And they grew back.
Yeah, the ability to regenerate organs appears to be controlled by about a dozen genes, and Professor Abair Katz, who is the principal researcher for the group, was saying that they're not sure of the genes' exact functions, but it seems almost certain that humans have comparable genes. One of the reasons why mice are used in a lot of research is that they're genetically very similar to humans and have many of the same responses.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently the only organ that did not grow back when they damaged it was the brain.
Right. I can imagine. All right, well, or remove that, I think is what the line says, but...
Well, no, if you ever cause damage to
right,
it.
Right, it didn't grow back. Okay, well, thank you very much. I mean, of course, if you had a brain that was healing all the time, you'd be losing memories, and
yeah,
that would be kind of problematic.
The ick factor, like, how do you feel about it? At the same time, yes, if I lost a hand, I'd like to have it back.
Right, of course. But if it's genes, it's very possible that existing humans can't be treated.
On the contrary, what they were... They injected fetal liver cells taken from one of those animals into ordinary mice, and they, too, gained the power of regeneration. This ability persisted even 6 months after the injection.
Great, so now we have a super serum to go for the mice.
All right, thank you, Miles, for the super mice story. Drew, hi.
Hi, let's see. First thing's kind of surprising. Poor old Creative Labs has instituted a partial product recall after discovering that it accidentally shipped approximately 3,700 MP3 players contaminated with a Windows virus.
Oh, wait. Okay. Put this in real layman's term. What'd they do?
They blew it. They shipped a product that was virus infected out of the gate.
You mean
from the factory.
The software that went with it or built into the handheld?
It's an MP3 player, right?
Okay.
So it's like an iPod competitor,
right,
sort of thing. And it has a Windows-based file system on it, which had a... it's called the Wulik B email worm. So the worm doesn't infect your PC unless you play... unless you browse through the files that are in this file system and click on the infected file.
Right.
But the fact that the virus is on the file system out of the factory, so you don't even know it.
So basically what you're saying is this virus on this hardware, you buy the hardware, you don't do anything else but plug it into your computer to copy your movies, your videos, your music over. Then you're like, well, wait, where'd that music go? And you look around, you find something, you click on it, and then your machine's infected.
That's exactly correct.
How many of these, I mean, if I've got one of these devices, should I be in fear?
Well, they posted a note on their website, and the serial numbers, there's a range that they know of that are infected, and they shipped in Japan in late July. So it's not likely that any of our listeners are going to own one of these things.
Okay.
But just the fact that, you know, it's a lot of egg on their face, I would
of
say.
Course.
And the risk of Windows-based file systems being infected with worms obviously is high. We all know that. And here's a case where it really affected these poor Creative Labs, creative types.
All right. Well, that's a shame. Creative Labs, of course, is a local company in a lot of ways. So, most shame that happened. I hope that they are able to fix the problem and not damage their business too much. I wouldn't be concerned if you've got a Creative Labs product. They've got great product, from what I understand.
And it could happen to anybody. It's just
could happen to anybody. But kind of telling about the persistency of these viruses and worms that new products can go out the door with them. I recall early in my web experience, we were distributing an application as a zip file, and that zip file looked like a Trojan, and it was a major problem because there was an application in it, and the way we had done it, it had the signature of a virus and caused major problems. So it's both sides of that work. It's difficult to distribute software cleanly and in the virus world.
It looks like in the factory.
At least on Windows. If you're on anything else, it doesn't matter.
They might have had an infected Windows machine in their production facility somewhere,
right,
and this virus spreads by copying itself into open share locations.
Right.
And so they didn't even know it got replicated over, and there it was.
All right. Thank you very much, Drew, for that. Miles, hi.
Hi. This story seems appropriate considering the recent news with New Orleans and the other coastal cities off the Gulf Coast. The Arctic could see ice-free summers in 100 years. Researchers at the University of Arizona and other universities concluded that the rate is accelerating, and no foreseeable natural forces will counteract that acceleration. As a result, ice-free summers loom.
It was kind of telling that in speeches that Bush is giving at this point, he's not mentioning global warming at all. Of course, the general administration acceptance is that global warming doesn't exist or isn't proven to exist, and yet massive bodies of scientists are saying it does. So, of course, coming out of Democracy Now! Definitely feels like the administration's not
doing it. Some researchers have speculated that sea levels may rise nearly a foot in 100 years. This is going to especially affect some low-lying coastal cities. Like, for example, we saw what happens with a low-lying coastal city with New Orleans, but also large areas, for example, of Bangladesh, which are mostly consisting of river deltas at sea level. The melt could also thaw permafrost, which could lead to an increase in greenhouse gases in the atmosphere.
But also the climate being that warm would change everybody's climate. We'd see more storms and so on.
Yes.
All right, thank you for that. I think we should probably do some shows on global warming because it's not being addressed in as much the public sphere as it should be. And us being geeks and scientists, we should participate in that and distributing that information.
We'll rent some scientists.
Rent some scientists, right? Yeah. Free renting of scientists. All right, thanks, Miles, for that. Drew, hi.
Okay, so this one is pretty interesting. We talked about DVD John, who's a Norwegian, they call him a hacker in the press, but he's probably just a really talented coder. He's hacked the encryption coding on Microsoft's Windows Media Player, which opens up the content broadcasts to devices on other platforms beyond Windows Media Player. So that means when Microsoft or Windows Media wants to send you a broadcast, it's encrypted in their NSC. NSC is the name of the encryption. And he takes it and he wants to play it on a different player, on a Linux machine or some other player. This what his hack has done is allowed you to actually do that, go somewhere else with the data.
So right now, for example, if you got a Windows machine and you want to play any media files that might be available, ones that you've purchased, ones that you've downloaded, friends, things, anytime you run into a WMA file, which is a Windows media file, the only player traditionally that could play that is made by Microsoft called Windows Media Player, and it is free on Windows and Mac OS. I don't know if they've got a Linux version, probably not. In any case, what this guy's done is figured out the way that they encode that media files and allows other people that have players to play those files.
It's something like that, yeah. Okay. I think it's a smaller piece of it than that, but he did it out of principle, saying he doesn't believe that the information that they're encrypting should be encrypted, and so he went ahead and decrypted it and broke it open. And this is the third time he's done something like that. He's a pretty talented
character,
it sounds like. He's in Norway.
Uh-huh.
He did it to Apple's the iTunes format, and he did it before that to the DVD encoding so that he could play his DVDs on his Linux machine, the Dexys tool.
Right.
And he actually got in a lawsuit about that, which he later won.
All right. Well, it's interesting. I don't know how I feel about that. I mean, to one extent, from a perspective of society at large, the idea that one company controls whether people can play creative content that they don't necessarily own is weird. So I, to some degree, I appreciate that at least the issue is being raised in the public sphere. Miles, got any take on that? Or you want to take one more news story?
I have. Well, my take on it actually is I disagree. I mean, people should have the ability to distribute. My issue is more like the length of time. But this particular individual was also responsible for hacking DVD encryption, as Drew mentioned earlier. And that one I was in favor of simply because I had bought it. If I buy a DVD, I want to be able to play it. And if you didn't have a DVD player, or at the time when it was first when the exploit first came out, you could only have a Windows machine or a Mac to be able to play it. If you had some other operating system, even if you legally purchased that DVD, you wouldn't be able to watch it.
On your computer.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so the software made it available that I could watch it, you know, as something that I purchased a license to.
Well, I'm not sure exactly the extent of this Windows Media exploit, if you will, or this hack that's been done to the codec. But my assumption is that it just allows people to play content that already owned. But perhaps it is more copyright stuff, more like...
The idea behind that Windows Media Player encryption was that if you downloaded a file, for example, you double-click on it, Windows Media Player would bring up a dialog box saying put in a username and password, for example, for access, or put in some kind of key.
So it was for protecting people's intellectual property, if you will.
Exactly.
Okay, I thought it was just the codec itself in trying to play those types of files. Not that they were encrypted, right, per se, but that they were part
now,
of the codec.
Now, in all fairness, when DVD encryption was cracked, it opened up the floodgates for people to be able to just copy DVDs.
Right.
So
it's a good
and the bad.
Right,
there's no good guy, bad guy, like, strictly speaking.
So no good guys or bad guys, but you are listening to Geek Speak, and we are that. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are Drew Meyer and Miles Elam. And we are going to talk now with author of the Digital Photography Pocket Guide from O'Reilly, Derek Story. The entire month of September is on Geek Speak. Will be digital photography. We're going to talk with a photographer. We're going to be talking with an asset management company, most likely a storage group, and probably someone from maybe Adobe, because that's a kind of interesting subject. So the entire month we're dedicating to taking good pictures with digital cameras. The author of a wonderful little book that I've been playing with the last couple of days, Digital Photography Pocket Guide, 3rd edition, from O'Reilly, Derek Story, now joins the Geeks. Welcome, Derek, to Geek Speak.
Oh, how you doing?
Quite well, and thank you so much for joining us again. You actually have joined us on a previous show. That show is archived on our site. It was, I believe, early 2004, mid-2004, something like that. In any case, go to geekspeak.org and click on today's show to see more about Derek's story and some links, of course, to some of his pictures and his new book, Digital Photography Pocket Guide, which is about to be in stores, if you will, right?
It's getting close. It's already online at Amazon and O'Reilly. And, you know, the whole book process is kind of interesting. So as far as the retail stores, it's got to go to the warehouses and all that distribution stuff. So I'm hoping that'll be on the shelves here in another few weeks.
And, of course, since it's hitting the distribution systems, it's in the system. So go to your favorite bookstore and say, I want a copy of this, and you'll be able to get a copy when it first gets in.
Actually, say you want three copies, buy one, and then there'll be two there for other people.
We appreciate the bookstores, and yeah, I get what you're saying, but I think the good bookstores will take this book on because it looks like a great little read. Okay, so let's start. You start out right away with the topic that I want to touch on, and that is, what kind of camera should I get? And you have three classes of cameras. Can you overview those for us?
Yes, I can. The three classes, and of course, you know, you could slice and dice this, till the end of the day. But the three that I like to use are compact, and generally speaking, it's something that fits in your pocket. And then we have advanced amateur, which is sort of a bridge between, you know, the point and shoots as we know it, and the digital SLRs, which tend to be kind of bigger. And then, of course, digital SLRs themselves, which are very much like the 35 millimeter cameras that a lot of us have been using for years. You can remove the lenses, and they have all sorts of accessories, and really what you see is what you get. You're actually looking through the actual lens. So those are the three basic classes that I use.
Well, I would say that the Let's not go into the SLR one, because I think if you're interested in getting SLR, you're going to want to research that. I personally, for looking at any type of purchase of digital camera, I like to read the reviews at dpreview.com. Great site, has a lot of reviews. Do you have a suggestion on reading reviews of
yes.
cameras?
Well, that is definitely one of the sites that I like a lot. I think imagingresource.com, and it's imaging-resource.com, is one that I read in addition to dpreview. Between the two of them, they usually cover just about everything I want. A third one that's worth noting that I also like his reviews are Steve's Digicamps. So those are probably my three favorite review sites.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and let's do that middle ground kind of prosumer line camera, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
What's important in looking for a camera like that? And what kind of price range are we talking about here?
Yeah, in the middle category, the prosumers, I think those cameras are really designed for people who, photography is more of a hobby for them, or something that they're serious about. It's not just the casual snapshots every mm-hmm. now and then. And the way that these cameras are designed are to really try to meet as many needs as possible for the photographer. So they do things like have zoom lenses that are more than just 3x. A lot of these cameras now have zooms that go up to 7x, and the new Canon model that just came out has a zoom that goes an optical zoom that goes up to 12x, and that's the S2IS, the PowerShot S2. So first of all, they realize that photographers that are serious about photography want to have, more focal length to work with. I think the other thing, too, is that they pay a lot of attention to performance and try to do the best that they can to get a camera that's responsive. They won't be as responsive as a digital SLR because, you're kind of in a different class there.
Right.
But in terms of burst mode, how many pictures you can take in a burst, in terms of shutter lag and all that kind of stuff, I think the electronics are a little bit beefier.
Yeah.
These cameras.
Now these cameras, one of the great things is they normally have relatively large lenses, which means they're better. They're good for low light, but they're also in general a more traditional camera, if you will, more like an SLR type mm-hmm. of camera. And also, you can't replace the lenses on these. You're not going to be in a situation where you keep on buying more and more equipment. It's one of those things that. If you're in the SLR range, you've got bags with you when you're taking pictures.
Yeah.
If you've got one of these cameras, you got everything you need, not necessarily for every single shot, but for a mass majority of them. And so it's a great solution for the traveler, if you will, that wants to take some
pictures. It is. And it's also a great way if you're trying to justify your hobby to a spouse or something to say, look, this is the one thing that I need. If you read my book, you'll also say, oh, and I need an extra battery and a big memory card. But
right, and then, a card reader that's fast.
Yeah, but, then that's about it. You're right, digital SLRs, and, I suffer from the same syndrome. There's always that next lens that you want to buy.
exactly. Okay, yeah. so those mid-range cameras, another couple cool features is you get to preview the shot in the display. Same with the micro cameras, the small cameras. You get to also preview the shot in the display. And it's a very nice feature because with that, one of the things you suggest, and that's for any digital camera user, because you can preview, you can switch to manual mode and take pictures that are adjusted more accurately for the mood and feeling that you want. Can you talk a little bit about how you do that?
Yes. You know, in the film days, you know, manual mode were for the brave for the most part, because, you know, what that means is you're setting both the aperture, the f-stop, and the shutter speed. And then the camera gives you some sort of feedback as to, you know, according to the light meter, how well you're doing. But you didn't, with the film camera, you really didn't get to see how it was going to look until you got your pictures back from the lab. Now, the nice thing with digital cameras is those, and again, we see this mainly in advanced amateur cameras on up. When you have a manual mode, you do get to set the shutter speed, you set the f-stop, and then what the camera does is in the LCD viewfinder, it shows you basically its interpretation of your settings. So then it's very easy for you before you take the first shot to say, oh, you know, there's the picture looks a little dark on the LCD. I think I'll open up the aperture a little bit, which would mean if you have it, for instance, at f8 at that moment, then you might want to open it up, make the aperture larger, the hole larger, to maybe f5.6 or f4.
Okay, well, I mean, we could get into the details of that, but let me just suggest this concern that I think some people may share. The stuff you're talking about is relatively complicated, and we're in an automatic world in a lot of ways, and there's the auto setting, which is what the camera ships in, and that's what you can do everything in. You never have to switch this manual mode. What's the benefit of switching away from that auto mode, which will make sure the photo is, you know, well, balanced light, if you will, but what doesn't it do that manual mode can do?
Exactly. Well, auto mode is great. And, I mean, these guys work hard. All these camera manufacturers work hard to make sure that their auto everything mode gives you great pictures as often as possible. And I would say that 80% of the time you can shoot in that mode, especially when you're outdoors in regular daylight. I think the other 20% or less, depending on, you know, how picky you are about your photography, where you go to, where you override that, let's say, not necessarily going to manual mode, but where you somehow override the auto system, is when you want to achieve an effect that is not just the standard, you know, what everyone else is sort of taking. My favorite example, actually, and one of the easiest ones to do, has to do with the flash modes. So you can still have the camera in, you know, program mode for the exposure. But when you're outdoors taking pictures of a person, say, you know, your daughter or a friend or whatever, the camera, generally speaking, isn't going to fire the flash because its auto mode's going to say, look, there's lots of light here. You don't need a flash.
She's a blonde. Her hair is lit up already.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Right. You know, there's plenty of light. The problem is that light could be coming from any number of directions. And one of the things, one of the basic rules of photography is that light coming from the side accentuates texture. Light coming from the front, you know, downplays texture. And when you're taking pictures of people, most of the time you don't want to accentuate texture because that means blemishes and all that kind of stuff show up. And it also really makes the nose, you know, look very three-dimensional and larger.
Uh-huh.
So you want that light coming from the front. So actually, the easiest way to do that is turn on your flash and get within flash range. So there's a override right there where you just go into your flash mode and say, look, make the flash go on, you know, turn it on, and then take the shot. Now the camera will do everything else. It'll balance the exposure and everything. But suddenly now you have a more flattering light coming in from the front that downplays skin texture and all that stuff. A very pleasing shot. And it's an override that you have to do yourself.
Okay, and you don't want that to fire all the time because a nighttime shot like a low light situation with a flash might not be what you are looking for.
Exactly. It goes the other way. I think especially on when you want to take kind of a moody portrait, let's say indoors by a window or something, last thing you want is the flash going off. You know, you want that light coming in from one side and then falling off the shadow. You want that feel.
Right. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. You're listening to Geek Speak. If you have questions or comments, the time is now to join our conversation. The numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can send us email if you'd like. Go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. Let's see. The geeks this morning are Miles Elam and Drew Meyer. We are speaking with author of Digital Photography Pocket Guide, Derek Story. KOSP co-sponsors the Super Kid Triathlon, presented by the Santa Cruz Triathlon Association. This event, on September 25th at the Simpkins Swim Center, is safe and good for ages 3 to 14 years old, who will participate in a fun setting. Over 150 volunteers will help with the day's events. There will also be an organization for disabled kids who also race. And the registration is now open, so go and sign up if you'd like for your child. For more information, registration information, please call 465-6517 or go online to sktri.com.
Return of the Native celebrates Grandparents' Day with a park spruce-up at Veterans Park on East Laurel Drive between Constitution and Sanborn in Salinas on Saturday, September 10th from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. with live music and a nature hike through Gavilan Creek. More information is at 384-6961.
This program is supported by a grant from CruiseIR, providing local and nationwide internet services, including DSL 6.0, spam filters, and virus protection. Information about CruiseIR membership is available online at cruiseio.com or by calling 459-6301. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. The Geeks this morning, Drew Meyer and Miles Elam. We are talking with the author of the Digital Photography Pocket Guide, 3rd edition, Derek Story. If you have any questions about digital photography, this entire month is the time to call. Today, we're speaking with an expert who knows kind of just like an overview of everything that you need to know about digital photography. So call in to ask us questions. You're welcome to do so. If you also have technical questions about operating systems or anything that you might be confused about, now's the time to call 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Or you can use the internet, go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. Now, Derek, your book, which, by the way, I find great for multiple purposes. One of the things that I'd like to mention about it, and this kind of has to do with the sorry state, in my opinion, of manuals that come with things. It seems like the manual for consumer line products thinks that the person that's reading it is the stupidest person ever. Like, I don't know how they think these people can like buy things. I mean, You'll go and you'll go to the setting for white balance, right, in the manual, and the manuals will list have little icons, because, you know, what would you do without the icons that are also on the computer to actually translate what that icon means to something? So now you finally see this list of icons and you go, oh, they're under white balance category, okay, and then one of them say cloudy, and it will say, the manual will say cloudy, to choose the cloudy white balance setting, choose this option. Which right. is, that's the help. That's it. You don't know anything else but that. How frustrating is that? It's like, you know, it's like a definition of language. It's not a definition of how to use the camera. So I want to read your situation. You've got a whole section of white balance, which is great. Your cloudy says, helps correct overcast skies, but is also good for shooting in open shade, such as under a tree. This setting adds more warmth to the scene than the daylight selection. Oh. So I just found that this is like a replacement manual, if you will, for your camera in a lot of ways.
It is. You know, first of all, those lousy camera manuals is what's responsible for paying my rent. So I'm eternally grateful to those guys for, you know, doing that. And, you know, the way that I start out in the book and the kind of what I'm rambling in the beginning there is what I say is keep your camera manual handy so it'll actually show you where these things that I talk about are on your actual camera. And so it becomes sort of a bit of a map where you do use those symbols to match what I'm talking about to your actual camera. But beyond that, I got to tell you, I'm not a big fan of them myself. And I particularly hate the ones that are in 8 languages. So, you know, I have this big, thick book, but only 20 pages of it I can actually read.
Right.
And, you know, those, I think those things are tough.
And you know, they do have a difficult problem. They got this piece of technology, which once you know how to use really well, is wonderful. But without knowing that, it's hard. There's a lot of settings. And people, you know, when they're looking in cameras, they'll hear shows like this and know this list of things that they need to get on their camera, so they'll look for it. And then it's got all these features, but the manual can't get into depth on it, I guess because they don't spend the time to hire people like you to write the manual. But luckily, we do have a solution with your book. I mean, and if you're buying a $300 camera or something like that, spending the extra, I don't know, your book is under $30, under $20, I think. We're not going to talk about specific prices, but it's not a bad investment to make the hardware that you just purchased really effective. So I personally recommend this, and of course, the views and opinions on this program are not representative of KOSP, but Let's talk about some tips and tricks to taking good shots. Let's talk about the white balance, since I just mentioned it.
Yeah.
What's the problem with using an auto white balance, for example?
Well, most of the time, auto white balance, again, like auto exposure, is really good stuff. And even just a step back for just 1 second, you know, white balance is one of the great things about digital cameras, because in the film world, we used to have to carry all these filters, you know, for these different lighting situations, and now essentially all those filters are built into our camera, and all we have to do is say, you know, now switch to this filter, essentially. And so, I think white balance is really cool. Where I think most of the time white balance, auto white balance, is fooled is actually in the example that you used. When you go into where you're shooting in the shade, or where you're shooting indoors without a flash, and sometimes even with a flash, almost all digital cameras tend to render the tones what I call very cool, which is sort of bluish. And sort of bluish is nice for certain things, like when shooting up, you know, like a steel apparatus or something, and mm-hmm. it gives it that, it's a neat look. But for skin tones, and especially for Caucasians, not so hot, you know. It tends to kind of give you the look like you're on your way out. So I think one of the best things to do, really, is to warm up the tones in the shot, or at least do a shot where you try to warm them up. And often the easiest way to do that is with the cloudy white balance setting, just going from auto to cloudy, and then take a look at the shot, and suddenly you have a little bit of that, you know, that skin color kind of comes to life a little bit, and, mm-hmm. and wood tones look a little bit more, deep and rich.
Now, why not keep that setting all the time? What would happen if you were always shooting in this cloudy type setting?
Yeah, sometimes what will happen is that when you're in a lighting setting, even broad daylight, but especially maybe near the end of the day, or you have tungsten lights in the room, which are naturally warm, at least the camera sees them that way, then you get very orangish. And when digital cameras go orange, when they record orange, they tend to really record orange. And so then you have a color correction problem.
Okay, so I'm familiar with Photoshop, as most users of most, you know, geeks are. You can fix some of these settings in Photoshop by changing histograms and stuff.
Absolutely.
What's wrong with just taking all your pictures in auto and then processing them in Photoshop? Is the only problem the time involved in doing that, or are JPEGs hard to change?
Well, for me, basically, number one is a time issue. But it sort of depends on what part of photography you like. And I have people show up in my classes all the time where, you know, taking the pictures is not the part that thrills them. It's, you know, what they can do with them later in Photoshop. So for that kind of person, I would say, why not just shoot in auto everything?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the real thrill for you is playing in Photoshop afterwards.
All right. Well, but for everybody else?
Everybody else, I say, you know, spend a little bit of time of learning how. You know, we're back into, you know, good data in, good data out scenario.
Uh-huh.
You know, digital cameras, just like every other, you know, digital recording device. So I'm sort of the camp, I want good data in. I want to record the best picture that I can, even if it takes just a few seconds longer at the time, because then all I do is upload my shots. And for instance, if I want to just send them right up to Flickr, you know, to share them with other people, or put them in email, or make a print, then I don't have to fool around with them.
Right.
Now, I can if I want, but I like just uploading them and then sending them on their way.
All right. Okay, from Santa Cruz, Dennis, welcome to Geek Speak. Oh, I guess we'll say goodbye to Dennis. Let's say hello to Rachel from Santa Cruz. Welcome to Geek Speak.
Hello.
Hi. Is this Rachel?
No, this is Josh.
Okay, Josh, hi.
Hi.
Got the lines messed up. It didn't sound like a Rachel. Josh, what's your question?
Yes, first off, I'd like to say, you know, maybe what would be a good follow-up is to do a Photoshop show.
We will this month, actually, yeah.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay.
The other thing is, we're having some debate. We're a group of mountain bikers who want to minimize the amount of weight we carry.
Uh-huh.
And there's two camps, the guys that carry extra film and the guys that carry extra batteries.
Right, so the film and the digital.
Yeah. So I was just curious, since I'm in the middle. I'm not sure what I should really invest in. Get a camera that, is conventional.
Right.
Doesn't rely on batteries. Especially when we do some backcountry stuff where we're back there for days. How do you recharge the batteries?
Okay, Derek, what about that? You got Josh here from Las Osas, and he is traveling with a lot of people that want to maintain low weight. And what do you do with cameras that need batteries?
Well, I mean, it's a great point. I would do two things right off the top, and then I have one caveat. First, I would look for digital cameras that have long battery life, and actually, these days there's quite a discrepancy among the models. One of the camera brands that's really making good compacts right now with really long battery life are the Casio cameras. And Casio, you know, was at the beginning of the digital photography revolution, and then they kind of fell out of favor a little bit because they didn't have their optics act together. Now it's all kind of come together, and they're really making some terrific cameras. So, for instance, the Casio EX-Z750 is a very compact, light camera with extremely long battery life, and then you get an extra one, right? Then you take an extra battery and test it, just like anything else. Test it, you know, see how it performs for you, see how many days you have with each battery, and then, you know, go that way. So that's what I say. Shop for a digital camera that has a good battery performance. I do have one caveat, though.
Uh-huh.
And the caveat is that one thing that's still true is that film cameras hold up better, generally speaking, under rugged conditions than digital cameras.
Good to know.
So if you think you're going to be subjecting your camera to a lot of abuse, rough handling, adverse weather conditions, all that kind of stuff, I would say that I'd still give most compact film cameras the edge in that category.
Now, Josh, I've got another suggestion for you. If you're going with a digital camera, I have an SLR, Nikon D70, which is kind of a big camera. I don't think it's a great camera for bike riding, but its battery life is amazingly extended by me just turning off the auto preview. So every time you take a picture on a digital camera, you automatically get your display shows the picture you just took for 10 seconds, whatever. That, of course, is using backlight and power. You can normally turn that auto preview off, and that means now when you take pictures, you don't necessarily, you're not using the display all the time. Of course, you're not actually seeing what the picture will be, so it's a little riskier. But if you're really concerned about it, that's one way to go.
Yeah, and then you can even piggyback on that. And if you find a good compact camera with a decent optical viewfinder, you can even leave that LCD off while you take the pictures and save yourself even more juice.
Thank you very much for the call.
And that was if they have an L... What was that again? Turn what off? What was the second part?
Derek, did you get what's the second suggestion you had?
What I was saying is that another way to conserve battery power is that if you get a digital camera that has a nice little optical viewfinder, in other words, you're actually looking through glass to take the picture, then you can leave the LCD monitor off while you're taking the shot, which a lot of people with digital cameras actually look at the LCD viewfinder while they're taking the pictures. That viewfinder, while it's on, is using
a lot of power,
battery power, and you can conserve even more by getting a camera that has a good little optical viewfinder and using that when you're in a tight battery situation.
Thank you very much for the call, Josh.
Thanks.
Okay, now we're going to try to go to Santa Cruz with Rachel. Hello, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi there.
Hi, thanks for waiting.
Yeah, no problem. So my question is not about cameras. It's about archaic dial-up modems, and I'm just wondering how you test a modem to see whether or not it's bad. I have a modem that will dial sometimes, and it won't dial sometimes, so it doesn't recognize a dial tone. So I'm just wondering how to test that, and then how to replace the modem in my laptop. It's a Toshiba satellite laptop.
Okay, so the first thing is, don't bother testing it. Just throw it out and get another one, because they're so cheap and so available. But you said this is a notebook, right?
Yeah.
So is it a removable card, a PCMCIA card that fits in the side in a slot?
Wow, I don't even know.
It's probably just
internal. I'm pretty sure it's internal.
Just a little plug that you've
socket.
Yeah, that you
absolutely,
plug in.
Just a little plug.
Yeah, that's not good either, because that's not something that you can replace or remove on your own,
right?
And really at all. So to test the modem, you can go to the manufacturer's website, and sometimes there are things called modem test strings,
mm-hmm.
which are little character sequences that will test the modem for you through the software.
Sure.
Check their support sites, your best bet. It's Toshiba, right?
Yeah.
Is the machine old? Is it like a Tekra? Do you remember the name? The
no, model? It's a satellite. It's pretty new. I got it a year and a half ago, maybe.
You know, if it's only a year and a half old, how often do you use the modem?
Maybe a year of that time.
And do you, is there any chance that it could have been shocked with a power surge or something at your house?
Maybe, except that it's, I have it plugged into a power strip, so it should be protected.
And the modem, the line runs through that power strip as well?
Yeah.
Well.
Oh, the telephone line?
Probably. Yeah, the telephone line is what's important, because that can carry it carries a really low amount of energy, but it does have some power that runs into it.
No, that doesn't go through the power strip, so maybe it did get shocked.
And that would explain why if everything else is working and that is not working correctly, but that's just a guess.
Are you saying that it works sometimes and doesn't work other times?
Yeah, but not necessarily. Somebody else is talking
I
to
think
me.
Rachel,
it'll dial and then say no dial tone.
Yeah, I think that you're going to want. Well, make sure that you got dial tone on that line. You can do that by unplugging it and plugging a phone in.
Yeah,
and also make sure it's going into the right connector. But of course, it probably is if it's a laptop. I think you're going to need a geek on this one, because to really troubleshoot this, we'd have to have that machine.
Yeah, I'm sort of going down memory lane now. I'm like ATDT.
But I do have a suggestion for you. Our very own local geek for KUSP, who does a lot of the services here, who's currently trying to figure out why we can't play CART systems, Josh Weiss. He is a computer consultant, and he's available for anything you want in this area. So his number is 831-247-3679, and I'll repeat that again in a few minutes.
Okay.
So thank you very much, Rachel, for the call. And you bet.
Hey, Rachel, are you committed to having that modem? Or is she gone?
No, it's going to be back up in like 24 hours, but...
Yeah, I waited out.
Yeah.
Good luck, Rachel.
Thanks.
All right, let's go ahead and go to Carmel. David, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Thank you. I have a question about the difference in focus or sharpness between DSLRs and the little compact one.
Okay.
I had a Toshiba 4300, 4-megapixel, nice little camera, actually with a Canon lens on it. Takes sharp pictures. I actually won a couple of awards with it. And I just wanted something better so I could blow up the pictures better and, you know, get better... the depth of color and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So I got the Coolpix 8800. It wouldn't focus worth being. Some people said it was defective, but I tried to take a picture of Santa Cruz across the bay once. It was so fuzzy, you couldn't even tell what you were looking at. I ended up getting a...
Well, it probably was defective, I would say.
It may have been. I took it back, and now I've got a Canon Rebel XLR with a couple of well-received lenses. But running through all the focus forums on the web, I found one guy, I think it was Steve Digicams, who said that DSLRs seem to be inherently softer or less focused than the little point-and-shoot cameras.
Derek, can you please address that?
I don't necessarily agree with that statement. I think there's a couple factors that are involved in this whole process. And... a lot of them has to do with what I call perceived sharpness. And what some camera manufacturers do, and especially the ones on you know, when they're making compact cameras, is that the level of sharpening that they apply in camera, a lot of times they're doing more sharpening than you actually realize. So what they're doing is they're actually digitally enhancing your image unbeknownst to you. Now, some cameras allow you to choose the amount of sharpening with a menu item, but a lot of them don't. Digital SLRs tend to sort of stay away from that whole thing, and you're basically, even with the JPEGs, which, you know, are processed, you know, in camera, they will allow you, the camera will allow you to adjust your sharpening to, you know, a lot to a little, but the default is usually on them pretty conservative, not a whole lot of sharpening applied. My guess is, you know, all things being equal, that we're really talking probably more about in-camera sharpening than we are optics and stuff here.
How do we get the same level of sharpness afterwards?
Well, in your camera, in your settings, you should be able to change the sharpness of the camera.
Okay, but it's too late for the photographs I've already taken.
Software. You just open Photoshop and sharpen them.
Yeah.
It's effectively the same thing.
Yeah, I would use in Photoshop, if you have Photoshop, I would use the unsharp mask filter. I think it's the most elegant and photographic of the sharpening filters that you have. And its default, it sets the amount at about 50%. You knock it down to about 20% or so, and sharpen and take a look at it. Look at it at 100% or 50%. And see how it feels to you, and then you can apply it a couple more times until you sort of get it where you want.
And again, what is that sharpness filter called in Photoshop?
Unsharp mask.
Unsharp mask, and you suggest 20% instead of 50%.
Yeah.
I've heard people saying go down to like even 10% on that filter, and then do it five times to get a 50% sharpness, and it actually calculates it better.
Yeah.
But David, you can totally do the same type of work in camera. I'm very normally take my pictures and they're extremely large, and then I want to send them. People are put them online, so I reduce their size. Anytime you reduce their size, you're going to lose in Photoshop. You're going to lose; it's going to seem more blurry. So as I reduce the size, I use that same filter, unsharp mask, to sharpen it up.
And I have a cool little Photoshop hack for you. That when you're doing that, where you're sampling down there in the image size box, when you're going downwards, you get another little drop-down menu where it lets you choose the logarithm for that and choose bicubic sharper instead of just regular bicubic, which is the default. And it does a very elegant, nice little kind of sharpening up as it reduces it. So,
ooh, I like that.
Yeah, it's cool.
David, did we get your question answered?
Pretty much. Can I do a little follow-up on the theory?
Go ahead.
The DSLRs have a bigger chip, a bigger sensor chip, and the little Toshiba I have has a tiny little one.
Mm-hmm.
Is there, since it's probably easier to focus an image on a tiny thing than a big thing, does the lesser sharpness possibly have something to do with the difficulty in making a big, sharp lens?
It's opposite of that. If you have a larger area, it's easier to make a sharper thing on that, easier to focus on that. But the lens is different. It's letting more light in from different angles, and therefore there's a concern. Derek, what do you think about that?
Well, there is another phenomenon, though, that's related to this, which is the whole depth of field thing. The little cameras, because of the smaller sensor and the optical physics involved, end up having this tremendous depth of field, which most of the time is good. Sometimes it can just drive you crazy if you're trying to do a portrait with a soft background. So again, another one of the perception things that you might be experiencing as you work with a compact camera versus a digital SLR is this extended depth of field that you get with a compact camera that might be giving you the feeling that the overall picture is sharper.
Derek, thank you for the call.
Thank you.
If you have questions or comments for the geeks, we'll take anything, not just photography, but any kind of geek question. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can try to shoot us an email if you'd like. Are we checking emails? Actually, in fact, we are. We have a lot. So, Gary Gardner from from Los Gatos called and emailed in, to ask about time-lapse. He's interested in learning which cameras have native ability to take a series of shots at a specific time interval. Time-lapse.
Time-lapse, I think the Nikon's compact cameras and mid-range cameras usually have a pretty robust time-lapse function built right into the camera. Canon usually doesn't have it built right into the camera, but they have good software that comes with the camera that allows you to hook it to your computer and control time-lapse that way. But then, of course, it's not quite as convenient. So take a look at the Nikon compacts.
Okay, Nikon compacts for time-lapse. All right, from Lee from Amsterdam emails in, Picasa is amazing. Just an FYI, if you have files, managing files, it's a great free application by Google. It's Picasa, PICASA.com. It works on multiple platforms, I believe, and allows you to manage your digital assets, and it's just a really cool application. If you're a pro or like a geek pro, if you will, kind of like myself, it doesn't do everything you need, but it is a great app. I've tried it myself. We will deal with more about digital asset management during this month of geek digital photography. Also, we get an email from Kathy of Santa Cruz. Can you recommend specific cameras brands in the middle group we're discussing? Looking for the best all-around camera. So what's the best all-around camera right now?
That's a toughie, isn't it?
What do you guys think about Olympus stuff?
Well, I like Olympus stuff. They have one in this middle range. They have one cool camera, the C7070. And that's a 7-megapixel camera, but the thing that I like about it is, you know, digital cameras traditionally have a hard time on the wide-angle lens side of things, you know, so you end up, your focal length starts at, like, the equivalent of 38 millimeter, which ain't that wide. The 7070, actually, I think, starts you out at 28 millimeter on a compact digital camera, which is actually pretty phenomenal.
Now, a C7070, what manufacturer?
Olympus.
Okay. Let's do that by manufacturer. So Olympus's right now, the middle range great camera is the C7070.
Yeah.
What's Nikon's?
I like the 8800, 8800. I think it's an 8-megapixel camera. Nikon does a great job on these cameras. It feels very much like a very professional camera. It has a lot of great pro features, good lens, just solid made. It's a good camera.
Okay, what about the Canon?
You know, right now, my favorite Canon actually is not what a lot of people would think. You know, a lot of people would say the Pro 1 or whatever, but I love this new camera they came out with, the S2 IS, which is the one that has the 12x optical lens on it, and it has image stabilizer built into it. It's a really hot camera, and it's very compact and has lots of great features.
And again, that's the Canon?
That's the PowerShot S2 IS, and the IS stands for image stabilizer.
Okay, have I missed anybody? We did Olympus, Canon, Nikon. What do you do in your next one? If you didn't buy any of those cameras and you wanted to buy one of these, because we only have a few seconds, what is it?
I don't know. We got to give Minolta, a nod here for the Yamaha A200, which is also a great 8-megapixel camera right there in the middle range. Good camera.
You're listening to Geek Speak. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. The person I'm pestering about cameras is Derek Story. He has a couple of books on digital photography, actually, by O'Reilly. We interviewed him a year ago. His current book that's out this week is Digital Photography Pocket Guide, 3rd edition. It's a little thing with great color shots. It's got a lot of information. I would say this is a better thing to carry around than your manual for your camera. Maybe you need both. It's got, it's 155 pages, and it's small. It's not that big, and it's a great reference, a great pocket guide, and I really recommend it highly. Derek Story, thank you very much for being on Geek Speak with us today.
It's been a pleasure as always.
The geeks this morning are Miles Elam and Drew Meyer, and answering the phone is Michael. Thank you very much all for participating in Geek Speak, and thank you for listening to Geek Speak. To those of you that called in, thanks for making Geek Speak what it is. Without you, it would just be us geeking out, and who wants to listen to that? Geek Speak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. Community Television of Santa Cruz County provided support for this program. Community Television is now offering a Director of Operations Management position, full or part-time with benefits. More information is at 425 425- 8848 or online at communitytv.org. If you're looking for information about geekness, you're welcome to go to geekspeak.org. We do answer questions throughout the week. If you want to ask us questions, we also have upcoming shows this entire month of digital photography. If you'd like to suggest a topic in that range, please feel free to do so at geekspeak.org. Coming up next is The Open Road at 1 p.m., Two Steps in the Blues with Charlie Lang. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Auto, or on the web at KUSP.org. For KUSP and for GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell.